Welcome to Akantra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akantra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're opening up a really foundational text in American literature. It's a book that takes us on this incredibly moving, sometimes painful, journey from, well, silence to finding a voice. We're talking about Alice Walker's 1982 masterpiece, The Color Purple.
Oh, absolutely. And when this novel came out, it wasn't just another book. It really felt like an earthquake, didn't it? Walker herself, you know, she's coming right out of the civil rights movement. She wasn't just writing about suffering. She was mapping a way through it.
And the recognition it received was just immense.
Immense. She became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for this. That alone tells you how significant it was and still is.
Definitely. But the impact, I think, goes even deeper than the awards, right? It actually gave readers, especially women, a new way to think about themselves. And if you really want to get Celie, the main character, and her journey, you have to start with this concept Walker developed, womanism.
That's so crucial, yeah. Womanism. It's like the bedrock Celie rebuilds her life on. It's this philosophy that really centers the strength, the wisdom, the deep love of women, particularly Black women. But it also connects their struggles to, you know, all oppressed people.
So it's distinct from mainstream feminism at the time.
Exactly. It gave Celie a way to find her own value, her own worth, without having to fit into molds created by, well, either white patriarchy or even some feminist ideas that didn't quite capture her experience. It's a framework for survival, really.
And survival is definitely the name of the game for her at the start, because the story throws us right into this incredibly harsh setting. Rural Georgia, early 20th century, Celie is completely trapped.
Utterly trapped. We land smack in the middle of the Jim Crow South. I mean, it's an environment basically designed to crush dignity, especially for a young Black woman. Celie's only 14, and she's suffering just horrific abuse from the man she thinks is her father.
And that opening line, it's chilling.
It really is. You better not never tell nobody but God. That single sentence, it just lays out her entire path. Silence, isolation, trauma.
It also explains the book's structure, doesn't it? Why it's written as letters?
Precisely. Walker's choice of the epistolary form, you know, telling the story through letters, isn't just a literary device. It is the story in our way. Celie is silenced, literally threatened into silence. So these letters to God are the only place she can even breathe, the only place her voice exists.
It's her lifeline.
Absolutely. It's this private space where she pours out everything, the abuse, her babies being taken away. And Walker uses Celie's authentic voice, that powerful African-American vernacular English, which itself is an act of validation. Even if nobody else hears her, the letters prove she exists.
And things just seem to get worse before they get better. She's married off to Albert Johnson. She calls him Mr., who sees her as what? Property?
Pretty much. Unpaid labor, a sexual outlet. It's dehumanizing. And this isn't just about one abusive man. Walker uses it to show how racism, sexism, poverty, they all intersect to grind Celie down.
Then comes another blow. Losing her sister, Nettie.
Oh, that's just devastating. Albert throws Nettie out after she fights off his advances. For Celie, losing Nettie. Nettie was her rock, her only real family connection left. Suddenly, she's completely alone, and she thinks Nettie might even be dead. The isolation is profound.
But the turning point, the thing that starts to crack open this darkness, it doesn't come from inside Celie initially, does it? It comes from other women.
Yes. That network of women is absolutely the engine of the novel. It's where the hope lies.
And the first spark is Shug Avery.
Shug Avery, what an entrance. She's Albert's longtime mistress, this glamorous, independent blues singer. Everything Celie isn't allowed to be. Bold, free, sexually confident.
You'd think Celie would hate her.
Right. But she doesn't. Shug arrives sick, vulnerable, and Celie. She takes care of her. She nurses her back to health. And that act of care, it builds this bridge between them. It's Celie's first taste of real, unconditional connection with another person.
And that connection blossoms into something incredibly powerful.
It really does. It becomes this deep, loving, intimate relationship. Shug teaches Celie about pleasure, about her own body, about self-worth. Maybe most importantly, she helps Celie rethink God, rethink spirituality. Shug is the one who truly awakens Celie, emotionally and spiritually.
Alongside Shug, there's another incredibly strong female figure, but maybe embodying a different kind of strength. Sophia Butler.
Oh, Sophia. She's just pure defiance, isn't she? She marries Celie's stepson, Harpo, and she absolutely refuses to be dominated by him or by anyone. Hell no is basically her motto.
She represents this incredible resistance. But Walker also shows the danger of that resistance for a black woman in that time and place.
Exactly. Sophia is a force, but her strength leads directly to tragedy. She stands up to the mayor's wife, this embodiment of white authority, and the consequences are brutal. Years in prison, then forced into servitude. Sophia's story is heartbreaking, a stark reminder of the immense cost of defiance in the Jim Crow South.
So we have Shug, the Awakener, Sophia, the Resister, and then there's Nettie, whose influence is felt even when she's physically absent for so long.
Nettie's journey is fascinating because it's so different. Her path to empowerment is through education, through knowledge, and eventually through her missionary work in Africa.
And her letters, once Silly finds them, are just game-changing.
Completely. Albert hid them for years, this unbelievable act of cruelty. But when Celie and Shug finally uncover them, oh, it just blows the world wide open.
Because she finds out Nettie's alive.
Not just alive, she finds out her children are alive, raised by Nettie in Africa. And Nettie's letters, they connect Celie's personal struggles to these huge global themes. The African diaspora, the impact of colonialism, the strength of African culture. It gives Celie proof that hope wasn't lost. That connection survived.
That discovery must have been the moment everything shifted.
It's the absolute turning point. Finding those letters validates everything Celie suspected about Albert's cruelty, but more importantly, it gives her concrete hope. Proof. Suddenly, she's not just a victim enduring things. She has knowledge. She has leverage.
Which leads to that incredible climax at the dinner table.
Oh, that scene. It still gives me chills. Celie, fueled by Shug's love, by the truth about Nettie and her children, by years of swallowed pain, she finally finds her voice. Publicly.
She stands up to Albert.
Stands up and speaks out. Right there, at the family dinner table. She confronts him, denounces all the years of abuse, and declares she's leaving him, going to Memphis with Shug. It's not just leaving a bad marriage, it's a culmination of her entire journey. From writing secrets to God, to speaking truth to power, right in front of everyone.
She even curses him. Right, a really powerful moment.
Yes, it's this incredible assertion of self, claiming her own power back after being powerless for so long. It signals her complete liberation, personal, spiritual, everything.
And her life after that, in Memphis.
It's like seeing her finally bloom. She takes her skill, her talent for sewing, and turns it into a successful business. Making pants, of all things. Which feels so symbolic, right? Pants representing independence, freedom, maybe even a kind of androgynous power.
It's not a simple happily ever after, though. The ending has this complexity to it.
It really does, and that's part of its brilliance. Celie finds her independence, yes. But the novel doesn't just cut ties with the past, Albert, Mr. He actually changes. Celie's departure forces him to confront himself, and he slowly evolves. He becomes capable of, well, actual friendship, of respect.
Which ties back to that womanist idea, maybe. That liberation isn't just for the oppressed.
I think so. Walker seems to suggest that when the oppressed reclaim their humanity, it actually creates space for the oppressor to change too, to let go of those toxic systems they were upholding. It benefits everyone, ultimately.
And then, the final piece of resolution.
The reunion. Nettie returns from Africa with Celie's grown children, Olivia and Adam. That scene. The culmination of decades of separation and longing. It's just pure emotional release. Family restored, sisterhood triumphant.
It brings everything full circle. Celie's spiritual journey, too.
Definitely. She starts by praying to this distant, old, white, male god who seems to demand suffering and silence. But through Shug, she finds a different kind of spirituality.
The famous line about the color purple.
Exactly. Shug says, "I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it." That's the shift. God isn't some patriarchal figure in the sky. God is in the beauty of the world, in nature, in human connection, in pleasure, in noticing the purple.
It's about appreciating life, the life she fought so hard to reclaim.
Yes. It's saying that truly living, appreciating the wonders around you, that is the ultimate act of faith and self-worth. Not just enduring, but noticing the purple.
And looking back at how Walker tells this story, the language itself feels so important. Celie's voice, her dialect.
Oh, hugely important. Using African-American vernacular English wasn't just for realism. It was a powerful choice to honor Celie's voice, to give it dignity on its own terms, outside of standard, often white literary English. It says her way of speaking, her experience, is valid and central.
If you had to pick one quote that just sums up Celie's final assertion of self, what would it be?
Tough one. But I think it has to be near the end, when she reflects on everything. I'm poor, I'm black, I may be ugly and can't cook. A voice say to everything listening, but I'm here.
Wow. Yeah.
It acknowledges all the ways society tries to diminish her based on class, race, appearance, traditional gender roles. But then it just throws down that simple, undeniable truth, but I'm here. Existence itself as defiance and worth.
That really captures it. It's a testament to resilience.
Yeah.
And it feels like the novel's core message, maybe. It forces you to look at really uncomfortable truths about abuse, about systemic oppression.
But it doesn't leave you there. It offers this profound sense of hope, that transformation, real change, both personal and societal, it is possible.
It's a celebration of the human spirit's ability to endure, to heal, and ultimately to find joy. Survival is heroism.
Beautifully put. Just surviving sometimes is the bravest thing you can do.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.